Nineveh, that great city, and cry out against it, for their wickedness has come up before me. But Jonah arose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa, found a ship going to Tarshish, so he paid the fare and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. And we were noticing the three cities that are mentioned there in those first three verses. Of course, the prophet Jonah is, we saw in 2 Kings, from the city of Gath-Hepher up in the Galilee area. But he is told to go to Nineveh. Instead, he goes to Joppa, boards a ship to Tarshish, which was the other way. Here we noticed some pictures of the ancient city of Joppa, which is today Jaffa, part of the metropolitan area of Tel Aviv. Here is the ancient area of Joppa. And we noticed there, it's right on the seashore. And of course, in Acts chapter 9 and 10, Peter is in the area there, raising Dorcas from the dead, and also receiving the messenger sent from Cornelius from Caesarea, about 30 miles north. And there is the view, and that's what Jonah's idea was, get on a boat and go that away. It's the opposite way from where he needed to go. You see, Nineveh is to the east, northeast of Israel, but he is going the exact opposite direction, due west, to Tarshish. Of course, that will be interrupted, and the actual journey will take him back to Nineveh, as we know. He will not get to where he wants to go, and Tarshish is over there. It is at the, they believe, the southern end of Spain, where today some modern cities, of course, are found. And we talked about Nineveh, that great city, as God calls it there in verse 2. He'll call it again when he basically gives him the same command in chapter 3 and in verse 2. Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city. And indeed, in ancient times, Nineveh was a great city. First built by Nimrod, Genesis chapter 10 mentions the name Nineveh for the first time in those early centuries of man's existence after the flood. Became the capital of the Assyrian Empire sometime during the 9th to the 7th centuries B.C. That'd be from the time of David on down through the divided kingdom area. 2 Kings chapter 19 verse 36 mentions Nineveh. But that was where King Sennacherib, after his failure to take Jerusalem, went back. So it had to be the capital then. That's where the king went back to. It's on the east banks of the Tigris River, now encircled today by the city of Mosul in Iraq. Nearly 8 miles of circumference around the ancient walls of the city. It eventually fell to the Babylonians, the next great empire, in 612 B.C. Now, we dated Jonah to somewhere in the reign of Jeroboam II. We know that's when he reigned because of 2 Kings 14, verse 25, mentions Jonah there in the historical record of the kings as working during the time of Jeroboam II. That would put him in the time of general time period again of Hosea. And Amos also, who are dealing with the northern kingdom of Israel, and especially Amos, who also prophesied during the time of Jeroboam II. And so we dated him sometime during that reign. We said approximately maybe 760 B.C. So it would have been about 150 years before the fall of the city to the Babylonians. So Jonah, approximately 150 years before the end of the Assyrian Empire, is told to go to this great city, Nineveh. So just think of that. We'll be talking later about the fall of Nineveh and the rise of the Babylonian Empire, but this is about 150 years prior to that. Nineveh, the ancient ruins of Nineveh, again sits on the eastern side of the Tigris River. There's a map of the city. A little bit closer, we mentioned archaeological work has been done. A few palaces have been found of kings that came after the time of Jonah. The king, there is a king of Nineveh mentioned, of course, in chapter 3. The king of Nineveh is mentioned in verse 6 of chapter 3, but no name is given to him. So we don't know for sure which ruler this is, but it's prior to the time of some of the most powerful kings of Assyria that would come along, that would take the northern kingdom of Israel down and would threaten the existence of the southern kingdom of Judah, in particular Sennacherib, and all that will all come after the time of Jonah. So it would reach its heights during the time of the palaces that they have found. There is an aerial view of it. Remember, there see the bend in the river there, the Kozer River, and just to the left of that bend is the ruins, and you can see them there. Some of the archaeological work, you get down a little bit closer, that's a rendition of the floor plan of the palaces that have been found. To the bottom there is Sennacherib's palace, where they found the wall relief of his attack upon the city of Lachish in Judah that I've shown you pictures of. Ashurbanipal's palace, who was after Sennacherib. Ashurbanipal was a king of Assyria. He reigned for 41 years, a long time. And it was almost to the time to the end of the Assyrian Empire. He died just before, I think the king after him was the king when it fell. His palace is toward the upper part of that picture. Here are some ruins. Walls that have been found. Usually they've had to reconstruct those walls, but the foundations of the walls were found so they could reconstruct them. Some more walls of the ancient city of Nineveh. Several gates have been found and reconstructed. And there's a picture of one of these at the end of the lesson, the first lesson of Jonah. What is the page? The picture of one of these, not as good, but page 46. The winged beast, it's noted there, was at the entrance of the palace of Tiglath-Pileser. He's one of the kings of Assyria, and he is mentioned in the Bible. It says there Jonah was no doubt familiar with this image, or one like it. It's interesting because it looks like what you'd read in some of the apocalyptic passages of the prophets. It's an image of the head of a man on the body of a lion with the wings of an eagle. And it sounds like something you'd read in the book of Revelation or in Daniel. And so there's several. Now that's probably the same picture that's in your, that's in the workbook there. But those, Daniel perhaps would have seen those very ones. This was a picture of Ashurbanipal himself. I want to zero in on him because he's important to Assyrian history and archaeology today. That he's riding in the chariot there with some other folks, and there's some other servants in front, one by the wheel. Get a little bit closer there, Ashurbanipal. And you can see the writing up there on that wall relief. That writing is in cuneiform, wedged writing that they would carve, or if it's clay, they would push into it. It's wedged writings. You can read Akkadian. You can get a PhD in Akkadian culture and language now. I have no idea what that says. But I'm sure it says something wonderful about King Ashurbanipal. That's what they put that there for. Ashurbanipal is important because he was a very scholarly king. He learned as a prince how to read and write Akkadian and Sumerian language, which was the going language in his area of the world at that time. And he became very interested in gathering lots of materials from all over the Mesopotamian area into his own library. And he had probably the earliest and largest library in the ancient world. When they found his library in the 1800s, two British archaeologists in the mid-1800s started working in Nineveh, found his palace, found his library that apparently was on the second floor of two of his palace buildings. But after it was sacked by the Babylonians, had crashed down into the first floor, but they found it a foot deep of clay tablets, prisms, which are round clay structures that they write on all around it, and other such materials a foot deep. They found over 30,000 pieces of literature in his library. Makes my library look pitifully small. Over 30,000, and that's probably not counting the parchments and the papyrus that was destroyed in the fires of the destruction. Clay tablets, they love fire. That just hardens them more. So they preserved 30,000. If you go to the British Museum, and that's one museum I desperately want to go to. There's so much Bible history there. But if you go to the British Museum, almost all of it's there, because two British archaeologists found it, of course. So the British Museum has all virtually everything of Ashurbanipal's vast library, well, at least what's left. And you can see it displayed here, the clay tablets that are carved. You can see some of them put up there, and that's the way they found them, a lot of them, still intact, not only flat, but laying up like books. And so you can see that, and here's another view of the tablets in this king's library. If we go a little bit closer to this one here, you can get a little better look at the wedged writing. When the clay is wet, they use a stylus to imprint the, and that's why it's called cuneiform, it's wedged writing. And so eventually they were able to understand, because like the Rosetta Stone is written in three languages, that's what broke the hieroglyphic language of Egypt. They also found ones that had different languages, texts written in separate languages, and if they knew one language, they were able to break the code and understand the other languages. So they were able to eventually be able to read these. This is probably one of the most famous clay tablets that was found there, because that tells us about the Epic of Gilgamesh, which was the flood myth of Babylon. And that's how we know that story, because of this tablet telling that story, their version of the flood story. So that's one of the most famous ones there. But that man gathered all that up. Now, if you still have one of those clay tablets that you took out of that library, you got a big fee to pay. It's been 2,600 years since that library was put together. 2,600 years old. So you would owe a lot. So, But it was sort of providence that these things were written on clay, because that survives the fires that would destroy a city. But it comes down to us and preserved a lot of history. Now, it isn't just epics like that, but they found among those things such things as medical journals, lexical, which means grammar texts, word lists. They found, of course, other religious texts, historical texts, usually the king's letters, treaties. They found divination texts telling about astrology and things like that, astronomy texts about the movement of the planets and stars. We learned a lot about this society and why God even referred to this as a great city. Now, he didn't say great because it was a wonderful and perfect city. It was great in the sense it was a big, powerful city at that time. That's why. But that great city had a problem. What did it say? What had come up before me? Its wickedness. That's right. It certainly wasn't great in morality. It wasn't great in properly worshiping the true God of heaven. But Jonah had a great opportunity. Jonah the prophet had a great opportunity to go to this great city, and even as an Israelite prophet, Israelite prophets, from what we know from scriptures, usually didn't travel very far out of Israel, but he is told to travel all the way to this Assyrian city, it may have been the capital at that point, to go to that city and preach to these Gentile people about the true God and His warning toward them. And to give them an opportunity to honor the true God by, as we'll see, God will give them a period of time to contemplate the destruction that He threatens to bring upon them. And so they will have an opportunity to do what's right. And so Jonah has a great opportunity to go out of his own homeland to another land and to preach the word of the one true God. What a great opportunity. I guess he didn't see it that way. Because he didn't go initially. He did not go. Let's continue reading at verse 4. But the Lord sent out a great wind on the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea, so that the ship was about to be broken up, and the mariners were afraid. And every man cried out to his God, and threw the cargo that was in the ship into the sea to lighten the load. But Jonah had gone down into the lowest parts of the ship, had lain down and was fast asleep. So the captain came to him and said to him, "What do you mean, sleeper? Arise, call on your God. Perhaps your God will consider us so that we may not perish." And they said to one another, "Come, let us cast lots that we may know for whose cause this trouble has come upon us." So they cast lots, and a lot fell on Jonah. And they said to him, "Please tell us, for whose cause is this trouble upon us? What is your occupation? Where do you come from? What is your country? Of what people are you?" And he said to them, "I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." All right, let's stop there for just a moment. So they encounter, he's on the ship. Where is he, by the way? I mean, where did he go after he got onto the ship, paid the fare? He went down to lower parts of the ship. We assume this is a cargo ship, not a cruise ship or anything like that. But a cargo ship on a long journey would have been a ship of some decent size. So he goes down below deck and falls asleep. In fact, the word that is used verse 5, Elena was fast asleep. The word here is not just a simple word for sleep, but a very deep sleep. It's the same word that's used, a form of the same word that is used in another part of the Old Testament. It talks about someone who was in a deep sleep. Anybody remember? Deep sleep, lost a part of his body. Adam, that's right. Remember, the Lord put him into a deep sleep and took a rib to make Eve. It's a form of the same word. I mean, he was out. Have you ever been in that kind of sleep where you just deep sleep and you wake up and you don't hardly know where you're at or what time it is? You know, you just lost all bearings on everything. And he's in a very deep sleep. So what's going on above deck and dealing with the rough, he's not even bothered by the rough rocking of the ship that's happening because of the sea. And yes. Yeah, he will be, that's right.
But the more he explained, I think the more fearful they got.
That's right, yeah. They're going to figure out who it is, and he's not going to escape. It sort of reminds one of like Achan. You know, he couldn't hide the spoils of Jericho. No. And this isn't just an unfortunate storm that comes up, you know, out of nowhere on the Mediterranean Sea. By the way, they can see now the bottoms of seas through radar and all that. The bottom of the Mediterranean is littered with shipwrecks, ancient and modern. But it's littered with shipwrecks. And of course, we know even Paul went through a shipwreck in the latter parts of the book of Acts. So bad storms can come up and they can take ships down. But this is no ordinary storm, is it? This is just not a stroke of bad luck. Because who brought the storm? Lord, yeah, God did. Lord brings this storm. Of course, they're unaware of that at the moment, although we see the mariners are pagan idolatrous men, and they believe there's some purpose to this storm, and they want to know who it is that has brought this up. So it's a mighty tempest, it's called. Ship about to be broken up, which means it's getting battered hard. These aren't modern ships made of iron, steel, and all of that. This is a wooden ship that these are probably men who live to sail the seas, maybe even Phoenicians, who were very much the seafaring people of that region. And they know, just like the fishermen on the boat with Jesus knew, that they were in severe trouble on the Sea of Galilee. They were experienced men on the sea. But here they have run into something that they're afraid for their lives. They're afraid the mariners. By the way, the Hebrew word for mariners or seafarers there literally means salt pursuers. Isn't that interesting? Salt sea, salt pursuer. Has the idea of men of salt. So they cried out to his God. They're idolaters, as we mentioned. They even throw the cargo into the sea to lighten the ship, because the heavier the ship, the more damage it will take. It won't ride the waves as well when it's heavy. So whatever cargo they're carrying, whatever cargo they hope to get, they're not worrying about that. Off it goes. You know, they save their lives and get paid for the next trip, hope, if they live. So it goes, but that doesn't help. Jonah's asleep. The captain finds him, perhaps as they go down to get all the cargo, they find this man sleeping while the ship's about to be torn apart. Notice what he says, "What do you mean, sleeper," or one who sleeps? He tells him to do what? Arise. Same word that God had used. Arise. That might have reminded him of something. Call on your God. You know, we get every God that may be out there, you know. Find out what that your God will help us. Isn't it interesting here that Jonah, not wanting to go to Nineveh, which we'll find out why eventually, ends up on a ship with the same kind of people. Pagan, foreign idolaters. And now he's going to have to deal with them. Trying to escape some that he didn't want to go to, he ends up on a boat with others. Irony. So they cast lots. What's the idea of casting lots? What are they trying to do? There's some way of determining. In Proverbs 16, we find that God often would make his will known through that. I mentioned that in one of the footnotes on page 44. On footnote number 9, casting lots was a common means of divination to ascertain the will of deity, whatever deity they may believe in. And God would reveal his will often through that. We know in Acts chapter 1, the apostles did that for the choice of the one who would replace Judas. And then Solomon writes in Proverbs chapter 16 and in verse 33, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. The Lord would also direct it to be done so that he could give his will. That's one of the ways that he could communicate his will. So it's not like us in drawing straws, and it's just a matter of percentages or whatever, or luck or lack of luck. But God could do it, and God used that means here to let them know who it was, because the lot falls to guess who? You said, David. busted in the sense that God is the one that lets them know who is the reason for this. It fell on Jonah, so they start questioning him while they're hanging on for dear life. They question him, "Where are you from? What's going on?" and he confesses that he is a Hebrew. That was a common name that the foreigners knew the Jews by. I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and dry land. He means he's a servant of the Lord. He's not being a good servant now, but that was who he was normally. Notice he uses the term Yahweh here, Jehovah. Notice the God of heaven who made the sea and dry land. He confesses that God, this is the one true God. He is the creator. No matter what they believed, this is the true God. And they could see what the true God could do. False gods can't do that. So, let's get ourselves caught up here. Jonah is the cause of those. So beginning in verse 10, then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to him, why have you done this? For the men knew that he fled from the presence of the Lord because he had told them. Notice that. He had already told them, somehow it had come up, or he just offered the information. You know, I'm running from Yahweh. I'm going. And again, like I mentioned last week, and like I mentioned in footnote number 7, surely he understood what David did, that you could go to Sheol itself and not hide from God, or the highest. Well, you can't hide from God. But he probably is making himself unavailable to God by putting himself out of the situation. I read one where they perhaps said that running from the presence of the Lord is like a servant that removes himself from the presence of the king. Basically, you're retiring. You're quitting. He's quitting. If you serve the king, you put yourself in the presence of the king. Putting yourself at his service. But if you go out from the presence of the king when he wants you there, you're basically saying, I quit. I'm out of here. I retire. Well, like a king can say, well, no, you're not. God said, no, you're not. That's not going to be that easy for you just to quit or to go the other direction and be all of a sudden unavailable. Now God has to get somebody else. No, it's not going to work that way. If there's something that needs to be done, we are servants of God. Opportunity plus responsibility, or opportunity, what is that, Tom or Bobby, do you remember? Responsibility, I know responsibility is the end of it. Opportunity plus ability equals responsibility, that's it. Opportunity plus ability equals responsibility. We're servants of God, we're just going to say, well, I'll let somebody else do that. Or I'm too old, I can't handle that. No, we need to be servants of God while we are able, and that's why we're breathing. There's something that we can be able to do for God. We just can't say, well, I'll just quit or make myself unavailable. Verse 11, then they said to him, what shall we do to you that the sea may be calm for us? So the sea was growing more tempestuous. And he said to them, pick me up and do what? Throw me into the sea. And the sea will become calm for you, for I know that this great tempest is because of me. That's a confession, isn't it? He wasn't going to say, oh, I'm sure God did it. No, he confesses. He says, it is me. And what you want to say about Jonah, and believe you me, he's not going to look very good at the end of the book either, but what you want to say is that he offers to sacrifice himself for them. Imagine that. Someone who didn't want to go one way is now willing to sacrifice himself on behalf of these pagan, idolatrous men. We must give that to his credit. So, he says, throw me overboard. So they just, okay, whee! Is that how it happened? To their credit, the men rowed hard to bring the ship to land, but they could not, for the sea continued to grow more tempestuous against them. They didn't want to do it. You know, give it up. Even if you don't recognize the true God, still there is human nature to where you do not want something bad to happen to somebody else normally. We don't throw you overboard. Well, that's death. You're going to die. You're in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea, a bad storm. You're going to die. They're not willing to do that. They said, well, okay, let's give this another try. And God's not going to allow it. And Jonah knows that he is being punished. They're all being, he's being punished, and others are suffering because of it. And he offers himself for those who suffer. Who does that remind you of? Well, that's right. One of the first true scholars among our brethren, J.W. McGarvey, who died in 1911 but did a lot of good work in writing, wrote a book called Jesus and Jonah. Still available. It's a good book to get. Just a little book. Jesus and Jonah, making some interesting connections. And that's one. He was willing to offer him. No, of course, he was guilty. Jesus wasn't. But he was willing to offer, sacrifice himself on behalf of these ones who are suffering because of him. Well, verse 14, they cried out to the Lord, said, "We pray, O Lord, please do not let us perish for this man's life. Do not charge us with innocent blood, for you, O Lord, have done it as we please you." Notice they take up the name of the Lord, Yahweh, Jehovah, that he is, they pray to. He's got pagan, idolatrous men praying to Jehovah. Wow. Wow. Amazing. And they pick. Go ahead. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And they know that they don't want to kill a man when there's no just reason for doing so. And so they pray to the Lord that that might not be the case here as they prepare to throw him overboard, that this will not be, that he truly is guilty. That leave it into God's hands to deal with him. They don't want to be guilty of that. They recognize that shedding innocent blood would not be right. So don't charge us with that. Do with him as it pleases you. And they picked up Jonah and threw him into the sea. And then what happens? It calms, yeah. It calms. All of a sudden, calms. Throw him into the sea. Whoa, I guess he was right. And how did they see the sea calm? Interesting, just like when Jesus said, "Peace, be still." It all calmed immediately. That doesn't happen. Now in Florida, sometimes it'll rain and then stop real quick, you know. But still, the dark clouds are out there and it takes a little time. But I mean, this is, whew. And just like the disciples in the boat, feared. Who is this that can control the winds and the waves? And how do these men react? Are they impressed? Yes. The men feared the Lord exceedingly, offered sacrifice to the Lord, and made vows. What an impact this experience with Jonah has on these men. They go from pagan idolaters to believers in Jehovah God. Wow. Through a man's unbelief and wrath of God, what an impact that has on these men. Who knows these men disappear from the scene here, but who knows from the rest of their life? They may have been changed men. They witnessed the power of the one true God. And they know who he is because Jonah told them who he is. And they offer sacrifice right there on the boat and make vows. Vows perhaps to be obedient to this one true God. What an incredible experience that Jonah, even in his trying to run from the presence of the Lord, becomes a tool for God to evangelize the truth. Don't ever underestimate how God can use you and me. Even in our worst moments, we can be a tool for God for good. If we will remember his will. Even in his worst moment, Jonah confessed his faith in the one true God and caused those men to look not to Jonah. Jonah wasn't a very good example, but they saw the power and truth of the one true God. And we need to keep people's eye on that and say, you know, I'm but a fallible earthen vessel. But God is true and perfect in all things. And he's the one I try to follow and all of us need to try and follow. God can use anyone, anytime for his purpose. And so we need to be ready to be used for God, hopefully in a good circumstance, not in a circumstance where somebody will see where God is displeased with us, but yet that can bring glory to God too, knowing that God judges sin, and to appreciate the judgment of God. Yes? Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, we said something about that earlier, that some people, just a myth, just a fish story. Of course, Jesus referred to these events, both in the first two chapters and the second two chapters, as real. And he based his death, burial, and resurrection on Jonah's, at least his burial, the 3 days and three nights, on Jonah's experience. So Jesus put his stamp on the reality and the real history of that. So, yeah, it's sad that many today want to eliminate this great story of God's power, His wrath, His compassion, His love, because perhaps maybe they see that this is the God they need to be listening, but they don't want to listen to. Yeah, it's sad that many want to just wipe this great story away, but boy, it shows God in His glory. Even in the time of the fallible mistakes of man, God's glory shines. Anybody else have a thought? All right. They learn and fear the true God by even seeing His wrath. People say, oh no, don't talk about God's anger and God's wrath. Hey, that gets people's attention too. And I'm very happy to know that there is a judge in heaven that will judge fairly and correctly and strongly concerning what's right and what's wrong. A lot of people in our society, I think, are looking for that in a very confused society. All right. Well, then, verse 17, the Lord remembered Jonah and prepared what? Great fish to do what? To swallow Jonah. You think, oh my, that's terrible. That's what saved Jonah. Jonah, what would have happened to Jonah otherwise? Oh, he would have drowned. And when we read his prayer next week in chapter 2, he describes his drowning experience. That what was happening to him as he went down into the depths, down to the moorings of the mountains, where it means down to the bottom. It was over for him. But God prepared a fish to swallow him. That was God's providential care for. He wasn't done with Jonah yet. Wasn't done with Jonah yet. Jonah might have thought he was done, but God, no, not yet. So, a great fish. Now, we often think, sometimes this is the only thing we remember from the book of Jonah, but there's only three verses that mention a fish. I mean, three verses out of four chapters. So it's not the only thing. But sometimes that's the main thing people remember, the great fish. It comes from a Hebrew word, dag gadol. It's a general term for a large sea creature. There is no word in the Hebrew language for whale, okay? There is no word. So it's not that, well, this is a fish, and a whale's a mammal, it's not a fish, so it could have been. The word is used for a sea creature, basically. And it's translated great fish. But there is no word, there are no words to really disseminate like we have different species of sea creatures. So it certainly could have been a whale. It certainly could have been a large fish, or it could have been a specially created fish. We don't know for that. Large enough to swallow a man. There are creatures, let me jump from this. There are creatures that obviously are big enough to swallow a man. Hurry, fella, get out of the way there. That's anybody know what that is? What sea creature that is? Don't say a big one, because we already know that. That's a whale shark. It's a whale shark. Pretty big. And there's been legends about people being swallowed by large sea creatures and so forth. But certainly God could use a creature such as that, or specially create a creature. God can do what obviously it's a miracle. The miracle of keeping Jonah alive in the belly of a fish where he would normally be digested, but he's kept alive there, so obviously God's hand is supernatural hand is involved in this. And he be there for 3 days and three nights, verse 17 says. So, again, there's no, it can't be a whale, or would it say a whale? Well, there's no Hebrew word for whale. Please understand that. And sometimes foreign languages are like that. Did you know in the Greek language there is no word for husband or wife? There is no word for husband and wife. You have to go by the context. In the where it is the elder's qualifications, literally it reads, he's the man of one woman. Man of one woman. Now you read your Bible, it says husband of one wife. That's our English. But the Greek has no word for husband or no word for wife. But if the woman's hooked to the man, they understood that that was what we call a wife. So languages are like that. And there's no word in the Hebrew for whale. So whatever, it is a sea creature, obviously, that would keep him alive by the hand of God. The Lord prepared this for him. And chapter 2, verse 1 says that Jonah did what from the belly? He prayed. He's now alive. He's not dead, as he would have normally have been. He's still alive, and he now prays. What a place to pray. One of the most unique places to pray to God. I don't know anybody else will ever be in that situation to pray. Pardon?
He's still panicking.
Well, yeah. He was panicking as he'll tell in his prayer because he was drowning. But now he realizes that God's hand is involved in this, and he's not done yet. And he's going to have a new attitude, a new outlook on things from the belly of the dark belly of this fish. Can you just imagine? But he prays to the Lord, because the Lord is everywhere. The Lord hears everything, everywhere, even a man in the belly of a great fish. And that's why he says there in verse 1, Jonah prayed to the Lord God from the fish's belly, and he said, I cried out to the Lord because of my affliction, and he answered me. Even while he obviously couldn't cry out in the water, but in his mind, he was crying out in desperation to God to save him, obviously. God was his only hope, and God did. And so, I think our time is up. So we'll just leave it right there, and we will begin there and look at chapter 2, the prayer.